Hi, Elaine Kazaya here. What you're about to hear is from a keynote talk I gave in May 2019 at a convention for a women's service organization. This event was about celebrating the generosity of women who had volunteered countless hours to benefit their communities. But the organizers wanted to also send a clear message about the importance of self-care, to remind the women how important it is if they want to continue to have a positive impact in the world. This seemed like a message that would resonate for you too. Whether you're volunteering your time, doing paid work that benefits others, or simply being a loving friend or family member, I know that you're a big-hearted person who cares about your impact on others. And that means that self-care really matters for you too. I've made just a few tweaks to the wording of this talk to remove the references to the nighttime banquet setting and instead adapt it to you as you're listening to it right now. This recording is a special gift for you as a Sea Change Studio email subscriber. It's not available yet anywhere else. Think of this as my thank you for coming with me on this journey and for sharing your ideas and input from time to time when I've asked for them. So without further ado, here's the talk entitled "The Single Most Important Thing I've Learned About Service and Self-Care." Today, I want to tell you about the single most important thing I've learned about service and self-care. But I'm going to share this with you in a way that may seem counterintuitive, as a list of 9 lessons. And I'll confess here that I'm a bit compulsive, so it makes me a little twitchy to go with 9 instead of an even 10. But I figured it was an act of self-care and a kindness to you too, not to force a 10th one for no good reason. This isn't a David Letterman-style list, counting down in order of importance. Instead, the last lesson I'll share is the key that unlocks what I think all the others have in common. Many of these lessons came from my work as a coach over the last 20 years, seeing what has challenged my clients and what has worked for them. Some of them have come out of my own stumbles and struggles. All of them have involved a lot of reading, research, and reflection, discovering answers that shed new light on what I've seen in real life. And so I'll be sharing a mix of stories and science here as we make our way through my list toward the one thing I hope you'll remember, even if you forget numbers 1 through 9. Ready? Here we go. Lesson number 1, listen for your oxygen mask. Hang in there with me. This will make sense in a minute. Lesson number 1 relates to the whole premise for this talk, which can be captured by a phrase you hear every time you get on an airplane: put on your own oxygen mask before helping others. We all know what that means. You can't be as helpful to others if you're not taking good care of yourself. And we've also probably all experienced living proof of this. Have you ever lived or worked with someone who's tired, stressed out, stretched way too thin? If so, you know the toll it can take on the quality of their work and on the people around them. But let's be honest, when we're wrestling with this ourselves, in real life, the self-care issue isn't as simple as the oxygen mask metaphor would suggest. There's no magical mask that'll drop down out of the ceiling during a contentious meeting, for example, to say, "Time for a little self-care. Take a deep breath, sweetheart." Or at 10 o'clock at night to say, "Turn off that screen, kiddo, and get yourself to bed." In real life, the signals that it's time for self-care are way more subtle. There's no clear dividing line between "I'm good" and "I need to stop and tend to myself." Instead, it's a zone in which our effectiveness gradually declines in direct proportion to our dwindling mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual resources. Add to that the fact that it takes an effort to do the things that will renew us, although often it can actually be way easier than we think. and that the pressure to keep going is high. And so we push ourselves a little further and a little further toward the dangerous end of that zone until there's a risk of it becoming one of those boiling a frog scenarios where we don't realize how bad it's gotten until we suddenly find ourselves being boiled alive by all the demands we've placed on ourselves. A little piece of science here as an example. Harvard sleep researcher Charles Leisler says that 24 hours without sleep, or a week of sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night, leads to an impairment equivalent to a blood alcohol level of 0.1%, which would be well above the legal limit for driving here in Virginia. But here's the main point. He goes on to say that, like a drunk, a person who is sleep deprived has no idea how functionally impaired he or she truly is. That's sleep, but there are a lot of other ways we can push ourselves to a point where we're no longer bringing our best selves to our work, or even our so-so selves. Times when we lose our patience, perspective, empathy, stamina, drive, and so on. And so this is, of course, why I'm urging you to listen for your oxygen mask. To pay close attention to yourself, listening literally and metaphorically for the cues that tell you it's time to tend to your needs, ideally before you get into that danger zone. Listen to the words that come out of your mouth, to your emotions, to the signals from your body. Listen to your own intuition. If you're paying close attention, you'll know when it's time for self-care. Lesson number 2 is about your body. You probably knew this was coming, so I figured I'd just get it over with. That said, I hope my spin on it will feel fresh. Here goes. We often think of our bodies as the enemy. Especially as women, we're trained from an early age to find fault with them, to focus on what we see as physical flaws and inadequacies. And then, as we age, we can start to feel betrayed by our bodies, aches and pains, failing eyesight, and other limitations we didn't have when we were younger, not to mention things like wrinkles and renegade chin hairs. But stop for a moment and think about how many favors your body actually does for you every day. In fact, let's do this as a brief reflection exercise right now. Tune in first to your feet and legs. Reflect on the various ways they've served you today, where they've taken you, what activities they've supported, pleasures they've brought, and take a moment to silently thank them for what they've done for you. And now your hands and arms. Think about the many ways they've served you today. And silently thank them. And now your spine. And your eyes. Nose. Ears. And mouth. Your digestive system, which is probably hard at work for you right now. Your lungs and breath and the circulatory system that carries the oxygen throughout your whole body. And let's end with your heart specifically, that miraculous organ. Maybe put a hand over it to notice its rhythm as you contemplate what it's doing for you right now. Your heart is actually not just a muscle, but also a complex nervous system, a sort of little brain that can learn, remember, feel, and sense. It's a part of your endocrine system, producing hormones like oxytocin, commonly known as the love hormone, and atrial peptide, which, among other things, helps calm your big brain's stress response. Take a moment to breathe kindness into your own heart and to silently thank it for all it does for you. I could go on at length about the myriad things going on inside our bodies right now without any conscious effort from us. It's pretty amazing. So lesson number two is this. Recognize your body as the faithful friend that it is, and return the favor. We have it drilled into us all the things we should be doing to take care of our bodies. Many of them are important. They benefit us and the people who depend on us. But truthfully, how often do you do this physical self-care from a place of gratitude, being a friend to the body who has been such a good friend to you? I can tell you, as someone who's viewed exercise as a grueling should for most of my life, it feels different when you do physical self-care in this loving way. Lesson number three, understimulate yourself. Okay, I know that sounds vaguely sexual, but that's not at all what I'm talking about here. We hear all the time about how overstimulated we are these days. The constant barrage of distractions and interruptions, emails, texts, calls, social media feeds, pop-up ads, and pretty much anything streaming. Some of these things are outside our control, but often we do this to ourselves. Whenever there's an empty moment, a lull in the activity, it can be so tempting to pull out the distraction devices we carry around in our pockets. For many of us, there's something vaguely uncomfortable about just being instead of doing. Boredom is something we desperately avoid. But those lulls can actually be so good for us. First of all, it's an opportunity to check in with ourselves. It's hard to hear that metaphorical oxygen mask when you're reading the news or responding to email. But there are other reasons too. For instance, we sleep better when we turn off screens at least 30 minutes before bedtime, although earlier is even better. And allowing our minds to wander can actually make us better problem solvers and goal setters. In one study, researchers found that people performed better on a creativity test when they had a chance to let their minds wander during a break, as opposed to people who did a focused activity during their break time. And much of what we distract ourselves with makes us feel bad about ourselves, too. The airbrushed images of celebrities and sanitized versions of life on social media. But the big reason to reduce all the distractions is this. When your mind goes from one stimulating thing to the next all day long, you get to the end of the day and wonder what happened. It's easy to start feeling like you're missing your life. If you struggle with this one, here are a few ideas for you. Turn off notifications so they're not clamoring for your attention. Use an app like Recess to force you to take breaks from your computer. Make your home screen on your phone blank as a reminder to pause and ask yourself whether you really need to be looking at your phone. Or get radical and try what time management expert Jake Knapp did. Make your phone distraction-free by removing your browser, your email app, and all infinity pools, which is his term for any app that provides a potentially endless stream of content. Lesson number four. And this may be the perfect one to come after that last suggestion about your smartphone. If self-care stresses you out, you're doing it wrong. Keep trying different approaches until you find ways that genuinely feel nurturing. Enough said. Lesson number five, serve from a place of true compassion. It feels a little odd to preach about compassion to people who I know give of themselves so generously, but I'm preaching to myself here too. When it comes to service, compassion is often what first moves us to action. But amidst our busy lives, it's easy for it to eventually start feeling like just another to-do on a long list. It's easy to lose our emotional connection with the reason behind our actions. You might be wondering why that matters. After all, you're still doing the good thing. But here's where the self-care piece comes in. Repeatedly, studies have found that when we boost our feelings of compassion through things like loving-kindness meditation or compassion training, we also boost our emotional, mental, social, and physical well-being. We're more likely to show up as our best selves, and then to serve in ways that will deepen our impact. So it's good to regularly reground ourselves in compassion, making it a conscious intention about how we do the work we're doing, not just why we're doing it. But I also invite you to think more broadly about who gets your compassion. Certainly the individuals and communities you're serving, but what about other people you're collaborating with? I saw a t-shirt at a walkathon recently with this quote on it. Everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about. That holds true even for the people who, on the outside, may look invulnerable. And what about yourself? Many of the women I've coached over the years talk to themselves in ways they'd never speak to others. They're so kind to everyone else and so hard on themselves. And it's not doing them any favors. Imagine having a boss, teacher, parent, or friend who berated you constantly. Would you thrive under those conditions? Of course not. Yet so many of us do that to ourselves. Kristen Neff is a psychologist who's done a lot of research about the benefits and mechanics of self-compassion. She's identified three key ingredients, and I think these hold true whether you're extending compassion to yourself or to others. First is mindfulness, paying attention and noticing suffering where it arises without over or under reacting. Second is common humanity, recognizing that we all struggle in these ways, that you're never alone in whatever it is you're going through. Third is kindness, offering love, acceptance, and a caring word or gesture. I'll close this lesson with something the Dalai Lama wrote in his book, The Art of Happiness. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Lesson number 6, speak your truth. I'm actually going to continue our discussion of compassion here. When I read something Brené Brown had to say about this, a huge light bulb went off for me because it explained something puzzling I'd seen time and again. Here's a quote from a passage in her book, The Gifts of Imperfection. The heart of compassion is really acceptance. The better we are at accepting ourselves and others, the more compassionate we become. It's difficult to accept people when they are hurting us or taking advantage of us or walking all over us. If we really want to practice compassion, we have to start by setting boundaries and holding people accountable for their behavior. She's not talking here about displays of anger and blame. She's inviting us to be kind but firm, to speak our truth about how we're feeling and about what behaviors are acceptable to us and which ones aren't. And here's the big mystery it solved for me. For a while, I was doing a lot of conflict resolution work with teams, and some of the worst conflict I've seen has been among some of the otherwise kindest people, nurses, chaplains, hospice workers. This explained why. When someone annoyed, inconvenienced, or inadvertently hurt them, they wouldn't say a word about it. They thought they were being nice, but really, they were missing an opportunity to resolve a disagreement or clear up a misunderstanding, missing an opportunity to get their needs met. And meanwhile, their silence was fueling their own resentment, making compassion and acceptance for their colleagues harder and harder. I get it. It's scary to say things that others might find upsetting. I find it uncomfortable too. But here's the question I always ask people in this situation. How might it actually be a kindness to both of you to say something? If you say it with respect and caring, there are so many more pros than cons. Lesson number 7, find your fit. In my first job after college, I was the third assistant to the president of a medium-sized nonprofit whose mission was to revitalize a seedy section of downtown Pittsburgh by turning it into a destination for arts and culture. It was an idea I found inspiring, and one that ended up being wildly successful. But the job itself was actually a huge mismatch for me. I'm drawn to art and creativity, but I spent my days organizing papers and answering correspondence. I loved the idea of transforming the city, but I only got to see it when I left my cubicle at the end of the day. And I'm particularly fascinated by the inner human experience, but the environment there was actually very political, focusing much more on outer qualities, like influence and prestige. As you can imagine, my performance suffered. I wasn't fired from that job, but I probably should have been, and probably would have been if I hadn't left when I did. But I almost didn't survive in that job in another sense. It sent me into a deep, deep depression. I remember telling my therapist at the time that I felt like a cardboard cutout version of myself. Dull, flat, not really alive. And along with that came a sense of hopelessness and some suicidal thoughts that were eventually scary enough to prompt me to do something that felt really drastic. Quit my job. It took a little while to heal from that experience and to learn enough about myself and the world of work to be sure I could prevent that kind of thing from happening again. But truthfully, I bounced back pretty quickly once I switched to a job where I felt like I could be myself again. And ever since then, my career has been a series of tweaks and adjustments as I've learned more and more about the kind of work, paid and volunteer, that makes me feel most fully alive. And I can tell you this, the very best contributions I've made have always come when I'm doing the things that make me happiest. As theologian Frederick Buechner has said, the place God calls you to is the place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. So the next time someone asks you to do something you're not enthused about, the kindest thing you can do for yourself and the person asking might be to speak your truth and say no. Lesson number 8, don't try to be anyone or anything other than yourself. Part of the reason I stuck with that miserable job as long as I did was because of a really poisonous question I was asking myself. What's wrong with me? I thought if I could fix myself, then I could finally be satisfied at this job that in theory should have been very rewarding. But my thinking was flawed. Trying to fundamentally change yourself is a losing strategy. In fact, it's not possible. Maybe you're familiar with the strengths research that's come out of the Gallup organization. The core finding is that we're much more successful in life when we stop trying to fix our weaknesses and instead build on and refine our innate talents. Talents might sound like a daunting word, but what they really mean by that is being you. I'll share another personal example here to illustrate. No matter how much I wish I could be a cut-to-the-chase, decisive, fast-moving kind of person, that's just not how I operate. And here's why. Because my brain naturally sees connections everywhere. It dreams up loads of new ideas, asks why about everything. It spots multiple possibilities and plays out multiple scenarios, tinkers with ideas and information until it can articulate their essence. It's a very generative place here inside my head. When I'm doing those things that are a fit for me, those tendencies are huge assets. But if I'm busy fixating on what I'm not, I'll miss sight of my strengths, and the world will miss out on them. There's a quote often attributed to Albert Einstein that goes like this: "Everybody is a genius. But if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it's stupid." Work with who you are. Celebrate your strengths, but also celebrate your quirks, your failings, and your vulnerabilities. All the things that make you uniquely you. My husband and I do a lovely ritual together each Sunday that we got from Rachel Naomi Raymond's book, My Grandfather's Blessings. She describes how she fills a bowl with water each morning to symbolize all the different facets of who she is and the life she has lived. Then she takes it to a special place in her home, dedicating all that it holds to the service of life. She writes, "I find that this practice has been profoundly healing to me. The thought that all things can be used equally to befriend life seems to soften the edges of things, to break down the boundaries between one's sorrows and one's joys, one's wounds and one's strengths. They may be of equal value in serving life." I'm awed by the lives of people like you who've joined me on this journey. I'm awed by your strengths and aspirations, your struggles and scars. I'm awed by the utter uniqueness of each one of us and what we have to offer the world. Let's embrace all of it. And now we've come to number 9, the glue that holds everything else together. Can you guess what it is? I'll give you a hint by recapping those other lessons we've talked about. Listening to yourself and tuning into your needs. Befriending your body, being alone with yourself during the pauses in your day instead of filling them all with activity, caring for yourself in ways that genuinely feel caring, enriching your life with compassion, including compassion toward yourself, honoring and advocating for your feelings and needs, putting yourself in situations that bring you more fully alive, and accepting yourself exactly as you are. Are you hearing what they all have in common? We've already agreed that we can serve more effectively when we take good care of ourselves. And now my final and overall point here is that we do a better job at that when we have a loving relationship with ourselves. That kind of relationship is a critical foundation for everything we do. And just like any intimate relationship, it's something you need to work at. So lesson number 9 is nurture your relationship with yourself. One of my favorite ways of nurturing that relationship is journaling. Not in a dear diary, recording life events kind of way, but reflective writing that helps me listen to and learn from my wisest self. If you're feeling crunched for time, you might think that journaling isn't for you. But while it does take some time, there are actually some really quick ways you can do it that are still high impact. For instance, taking 5 minutes in the morning to choose an intention for how you want to orient toward your day, and then offering yourself 2 or 3 sentences of loving advice. But there are plenty of other ways you can nurture that relationship. In fact, doing the other things we've talked about so far is an excellent way. If you do those things for yourself day in and day out, You'll be offering yourself evidence that you value yourself, that you are worthy of your own care and attention, that you are investing in yourself and in what matters to you. I have a saying, a philosophy, that drives everything I do. Life is beautiful. Don't miss it. To me, it's a reminder of how precious each of our lives are and how filled with potential they are. The key to unlocking that potential, I've learned, lies in our intimate and ever-evolving relationship with ourselves. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the good things you do in this world. And thank you for your presence with me on this journey of living ever more fully into our beautiful lives.